Welcome to the Review of Democracy, the journal of the CEU Democracy Institute, where we discuss some of the most significant new developments and some of the most exciting new ideas concerning the past, present, and future of democracies across the globe. I am Ferenc Lotzó, I will be your host, and it is my very special pleasure to be discussing with Peter Beinart today. Welcome to the show, Peter, and thanks so much for joining.
Thank you.
Amazing to have you here at the Review of Democracy. Peter Beinart is a professor of journalism and political science at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York. He is editor-at-large at Jewish Currents, a leading publication of American Jewish progressives, and an influential public commentator who runs his own Substack, the Beinart Notebook, which I can highly recommend to our listeners. Now, in an op-ed you recently published in the New York Times under the title, "There is a Jewish Hope for Palestinian Liberation, It Must Survive," you make the following, I think, very powerful statement, Peter. The role of non-Palestinians should be to help create the conditions that allow the ethical resistance of Palestinians to succeed. Now, that immediately raises, I think, at least two questions. How would you distinguish between ethical and unethical resistance? And how come the more ethical ways of Palestinian resistance to oppression have not succeeded more?
Thanks. I guess at a really crude level, by ethical, I mean not targeting civilians. And more generally, I'm thinking of conduct that adheres to international law. And I guess more broadly than that, I mean resistance that aims towards a vision of equality and mutual coexistence rather than domination or expulsion. I think that Palestinians over the last century have tried a whole range of different strategies. What I tried to argue in this piece was that in recent decades, they've tried a number of things that I think would be considered ethical, whether it's going to the United Nations, the International Criminal Court, or efforts at boycotts and divestment and sanction, or even just doing security cooperation with Israel in order to try to reassure Israel that Palestinians can be trusted with their own state. And Israel, with America's support, has basically defeated all of those strategies, which doesn't mean that Israel and America are responsible for what Hamas did. Hamas is responsible for what Hamas did, but it does mean that we have essentially empowered Hamas by shutting down other alternatives.
Thank you so much. That's certainly a great introduction to our conversation. Now, there has also been much debate in recent weeks, and much of this has been really quite forceful, regarding how one should, on the one hand, emphasize the very clear responsibility of Hamas for the horrifying attacks on Israeli citizens that began the current cycle of escalating violence, and how one can, and maybe even should, relate those awful mass crimes to the broader context, right? That is to say, the conditions that have existed for years and even for decades in Gaza and for Palestinians more generally. So it seems to me that, you know, the debate around this whole narrative of decolonization has been really at the heart of much of this public polemic. So may I ask you to comment on how you would relate to this whole discussion around condemnation and contextualization, and how you see the role of the decolonization narrative in this?
So I think there has to be a space in which one can both condemn something morally, but also explain the context in which it happens with an effort to make sure it doesn't happen again. It seems to me, if you can't do that, you can't really have productive conversations about a whole range of subjects, right? In terms of decolonization, this word is used a lot in kind of left and pro-Palestinian circles, but I don't find that it's often very clearly defined what it means. And to me, the ambiguity is problematic because decolonization can look, they're very different kinds of decolonizations, right? So if your decolonization model is Algeria, then you're imagining that the Israeli Jews are going to go somewhere else. If your decolonization model is, I don't know, South Africa, then it leads to a very different conclusion. So, you know, I would prefer that instead of just using the term decolonization with all of those ambiguities, intellectual and moral, that people explain what they mean by that, find some other language, even if it's just ethical decolonization or something like this. I think that when people don't do that, I think that sometimes it's because I think there are divisions within the left on these questions, and sometimes people are trying to paper over those divisions, but I don't actually think that's productive.
Great. Thank you so much. Now, another thing you have argued in recent weeks is that the massive Israeli efforts at retaliation, which is nominally aimed at eliminating Hamas, but it is also increasingly taking the shape of a campaign of ethnic cleansing. And again, there's a lot of debate about the terminology there, which we don't need to go into. But what you have argued that this is not only morally wrong, but it's actually also very likely to prove counterproductive. Mm. So could you explain why you think that the ongoing military campaign would prove counterproductive? And then what immediate response or also what long-term strategy you would have preferred after those horrific attacks by Hamas?
I think it's going to prove counterproductive because although Israel can kill a lot of Hamas members and destroy a lot of their weapons and their infrastructure, I think it will not be able to rule Gaza nor install anyone else who can rule Gaza without facing an insurgency. And I don't think Israel is going to be able to put down that insurgency. The idea that you could put the Palestinian Authority in charge in Gaza seems to me totally fictional. The Palestinian Authority couldn't stay in control in Gaza in 2007, and they're much weaker. So Israel would have to be the army that was keeping the Palestinian Authority in power. And then that, I think, is going to invite Israel to be an insurgency in Gaza, which is going to be costly for Israel and is going to undermine whatever reputation for military strength and deterrence Israel is trying to recreate. Plus, of course, when you kill, we know that Hamas recruits its members from people whose families have been killed from Israel. So you're producing many more members of Hamas or whatever new name comes under, right? So I think that the strategy that I would have wished Israel pursued would be a much more targeted response against the specific people who masterminded and carried out these attacks, not against the population of Gaza in general, ceasefire and negotiation for release of the hostages, and then an effort to take steps to show Palestinians that there are alternative paths to freedom that strengthen forces outside of Hamas. So you could do that in a number of ways, but you could release Marwan Barghouti, who's the most popular Palestinian politician, who's more popular than leaders of Hamas. You could hold Palestinian elections to try to create a more legitimate leadership. You could withdraw settlements, especially the settlements from which settlers are terrorizing Palestinians. You could reaffirm the status quo at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. You could say that there will be no normalization with Saudi Arabia absent a resolution of the Palestinian question. I think those moves would change the conversation in Palestinian politics. Now, this Israeli government will not do any of it, but my hope is that you could lay out some ideas that perhaps when Israel goes to elections, and those elections may produce a very different kind of government, perhaps, because Netanyahu and Likud have been quite discredited by October 7th, then maybe it creates the possibility of something to build on.
Mm-hmm. I can perhaps confess that I'm a huge fan of the Beinart notebook, and two minimal parallel moral demands we might formulate is that Palestinians should oppose attacks on Jewish civilians, and Jews should support Palestinians to resist in humane ways. But defending and propagating Palestinian freedom and equality may never have been more difficult within the Jewish communities than it is today. And also cooperation efforts among members of various relevant groups, various relevant stakeholders, however they may be defined, have also gravely suffered and may even have been ruptured in recent weeks. So one thing that struck, I think, various observers is that the escalating violence we have seen in recent weeks has reactivated traumatic memories, right? The memory of powerlessness, of pogroms, even of the Holocaust among many Jewish people on the one hand, and also the memory of the Nakba among Palestinians who have to fear and may already be experiencing a wave of ethnic cleansing on the other. And since you have been active in fostering very difficult and really essential dialogues across those dividing lines, and I think these attempts have really become much more urgent, I wanted to ask you, how could Israeli Jews and Palestinians be brought together now? How might they be able to recognize just how intertwined their stories and their tragedies are? Or more generally, how do you see the chances of de-escalation?
I think the chances look pretty unlikely right now. Israeli Jews overwhelmingly believe that they need to destroy Hamas. There are divisions among Israeli Jews about what else they agree or don't agree about, but they overwhelmingly support essentially this attack on Gaza. I would say if I were looking for places to look for hope, I think that the role of Palestinian citizens of Israel has been really important. Palestinian citizens of Israel are really uniquely positioned as members of the Israeli state who have citizenship and who are very deeply familiar with Israeli Jewish society, much more so, I think, often than Palestinians in the West Bank, let alone Gaza, but also who are members of the Palestinian people and who have some, even though they're very discriminated against, some democratic capacity to speak and organize, even though it's limited. I think some of the most important work has come out of, there's a group called Omdim Beyachad, Standing Together, which is a group of Palestinian citizens and Israeli Jews, I think has been very important. The op-ed that Ayman Odeh, who's the leader of the Hadash party, is mostly Palestinian Communist Party, wrote. These were statements that were, I think, made clear condemnations of what happened, of the attack on October 7th, but were also put it within a context of ongoing violence and were weakly kind of humanistic. In the U.S., we see that although this event has pushed some Jews, maybe many Jews, to the right, because it's kind of reaffirmed many of their deepest fears, there's another group of American Jews on the left who tend to be younger, who are organizing with Palestinians and others on behalf of a ceasefire. And I think from that organizing, we can see greater. I think that organizing is very, very important because it brings people together across these tribal and ethnic and religious divisions in pursuit of certain kind of vision. And I think if we want to create a Palestinian movement that is fundamentally about human rights and basic principles, not just kind of about one tribe versus another, those movements create the possibility of doing that.
Thank you so much. I have a final question to pose, which is slightly more personal. You are known as a prominent Jewish thinker, as a progressive public intellectual who emphasizes that Jews have familial obligations to one another and that Judaism has a universal ethical message about mm-hmm. the dignity of all people. Yeah. So in closing, I wish to ask you about two difficult questions in connection yeah. with those points. So how could progressive Jews like yourself balance that obligation and that ethical yeah. message in yeah. the current moment?
Yeah.
And how have you personally tried to navigate the tensions that have arisen between the two in recent weeks, in these weeks of despair and rage?
Right, right. It's a good question. It's a difficult question. I don't have, I think, clear and kind of pat answers to these things. To me, what I find, this tension within Judaism is part of what I find so interesting about Judaism. And there are times when it feels like it can be a creative tension, because in a sense, I do think none of us are pure deracinated universalists. We're all people who are rooted in some sort of obligations. And that's what gives our lives, it's part of what gives substance and texture to our lives. And that perhaps from that, from those things, it gives us the ability to then speak and engage with others in a deeper way. But there are other times when, like this moment, where that tension feels much more brutal and more kind of zero sum. I would say, I guess the way I think about it is that there are many ways to invest and deepen and express one's sense of obligations to Jewish tradition, to Jewish texts, to Jewish law, to Jewish community that don't come at the expense of Palestinians, right? There are many things that, what saddens me is that when I feel like the way that sometimes in Jewish establishment institutions in the United States and in Israel, this notion of a kind of a sense of solidarity, inter-Jewish solidarity, becomes conflated with support for a set of policies that harm Palestinians, because I think there are other ways of expressing that kind of solidarity, right? And partly it comes from a recognition that while we may have the right to have a special sense of feeling and connection and concern for people of, you know, for other Jews, we can also recognize that there is a deep interconnectedness between the fate of Jews and Palestinians. So that for the most part, this is not a zero-sum trade-off, that I think that it's often perceived that way. But in reality, you know, it is Israel's policies. You know, Israel's policies on the one hand are always focused on the idea of security and Jewish safety. But I think that by creating so much despair and imposing so much violence on Palestinians, they've also created the context in which Israel has, although it has a lot of power, it actually isn't doing that great a job of keeping Jews safe. You know, I mean, the irony is that although Jews often see Israel as the safe haven, the truth of the matter is it's safer to be a Jew in the United States, you know, or even in Western Europe than it is in Israel. And I think that, you know, the biggest reason for that is that the United States and Western European countries, or Australia, Canada, for all of their sins, are not holding other people under occupation and imposing that kind of violence. So I guess for me, I look for ways of deepening our sense of obligation to one another in ways that don't come at the cost of Palestinians, and similarly, trying to minimize the tension between the universal obligations and the ones that we have to ourselves, by emphasizing the degree to which our fates are intertwined, and that what's good for Palestinians is very frequently, in the long term, also good for Jews.
Thank you so much for that substantial and nuanced response, and for the entire conversation today, Peter.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
The pleasure has been all mine. I have been discussing with Peter Beinart today, who is professor, commentator, editor-at-large at Jewish Currents, host of the Beinart Notebook, and a leading progressive American Jewish voice. I hope you have enjoyed our conversation about some of the most difficult questions of our current moment. Until the next conversation here at the Review of Democracy.